Hello and welcome to Travels Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with Colourgraph. I'm Artemis, and in today's episode, we're travelling to Paris in the year 1572 to witness a wedding that promised to heal a nation and a massacre that destroyed it. You look back at this period of history and you think, as a novelist, you can't improve on it. That's how my guest, the international best-selling author Kate Moss, described the year we'll be visiting today. It's a moment in French history which is packed with just about every dramatic component you could possibly imagine. There's a young couple forced into marriage, drunken celebrations after a big royal wedding, deep personal and political rivalries, assassinations, poisonings, I could go on, all set against the backdrop of one of the most important Renaissance cities of the time, Paris. As you'll hear, Kate's descriptions of the summer of 1572 are romantic, almost cinematic, but we also grapple with some timeless themes in human history, in particular, the fear of the other. Kate Moss is the author of 10 novels, including the number one multi-million selling Languedoc trilogy. Her books have been translated into 38 languages and published in more than 40 countries. In 2013, she was awarded an OBE for her services to literature and women, and her latest novel, The City of Tears, is the second in her The Burning Chamber series. I spoke to Kate just last week. Thank you so much for joining us on Travels Through Time, Kate. It's such a pleasure to have you. I know you must be so busy promoting your book. So yeah, thank you for squeezing us in.
It's brilliant to be here. It's lovely talking to people outside my household.
Yes, I feel exactly the same way. In fact, I have to thank you for writing this book because I read it during the third national lockdown in the UK and I was just not leaving my house at all. And yet, every time I read this book, I was on these amazing adventures with these amazing characters. So it was just...
Oh, thank you. Yes, it's the one time when writing a mighty book, over 500 pages, a lot of people have said, this is what we need in lockdown, a book to see us through. So it's great for me.
Exactly. So I know that you've written in your work, you've written about lots of different historical periods, medieval France and also modern day as well. But I was just wondering what made you decide to set on the wars of religion? What drew you to this particular subject and time period?
Well, usually for me, because most of my historical fiction are love letters to Carcassonne in the southwest of France. And as you say, I have written about that particular city and Toulouse and Languedoc at different periods in its history. And that's part of what I've enjoyed to do, to see what would it look like 800 years ago, 400 years ago, you know, a place that I love. But in fact, this whole series of books, there's four books in all, which will cover 300 years from 1562 to 1862. And The City of Tears is the second of those. And that runs from 1572 to 1594. It started on the other side of the world, this series, in Franschhoek in South Africa. The prologue is set there in 1862. And it was going to that wonderful frontier town, as it once was, in the Western Cape for the first time and learning about the history of a handful of Huguenot families who, fleeing persecution in Europe, particularly after the revocation of the Edict of Nantes in 1688, had found their way via Amsterdam as refugees to the Cape. And I was just blown away by this piece of history and standing in the Huguenot graveyard there and seeing all the old names. And I found that very, very moving. And then, of course, it meant that I then wanted to know who were these people who were refugees twice, really. They'd fled from France to Amsterdam and then Amsterdam to the Cape. And out of that, I thought, oh, I think I have a story here. And so, of course, being in love with Carcassonne, I thought, right, well, I will go right back to the Wars of Religion and start there and find what Carcassonne was like when the Wars of Religion broke out. So for me, it's never the history that comes first. It's the combination of the history and place, finding out what it was like to be in a particular place at a particular period in history, and then off I go.
Mm. And I noticed as well that in a lot of your work, there's always this really strong connection between between great swathes of history. It's never just like focused on one particular moment. You're connecting it to something that happens later, like you're saying with these series of books that they cover 300 years of history. And yeah, I just wanted to talk a bit about that, because I guess in some ways that's kind of what we try to do on the podcast with the time traveling aspect, about finding connections between something that happened, something that seems so remote, and then finding links to it across hundreds of years.
Well, we are who we are because of the people who came before us. You know, it sounds so blindingly obvious to say it, but nonetheless, it needs repeating. You know, we are indebted to the past. We are also sometimes overshadowed by the past. The mistakes that were made in the past are ones that, if we learned anything, it would be to not repeat them. But often history, as we know, you know, is a pendulum. It goes backwards and forwards. It doesn't move forward, you know, wonderfully, everything getting better all the time and staying there. And so for me, I think I'm always interested in standing in other people's shoes, standing in the history, the shoes of the people of the past, and asking those questions. Who would I have been? Would I have had the courage in the wars of religion to stand firm for what I believed in? Would I have had the courage to shield people or to hide people? You know, I'm older than you are, but I'm lucky enough, and you are lucky enough, we haven't lived through a period of war in our own country in the way that many people, of course, have and are still doing in other parts of the world. But my father, he fought in the Second World War. And it was very interesting towards the end of his life when I would talk to him about the things he'd learned about being part of history. And I think now, almost uniquely in my lifetime, we all know we are living through history, whereas actually 5 years ago, we didn't. You know, and I would do events and I would say, you know, of course, I write imaginary characters against the backdrop of real history, of big, violent, changing history that alters the world on its axis. And we don't know when we're living through history, but they did. And now, of course, I can't say that, because the combination of Brexit and the previous president and certainly the pandemic, we know that this is a period of time now that people, our descendants, will look back on and study. And that is a wonderful thing for a historical novelist, because that's what I try to do about is to put the emotions and the truths of people of the past on the page. Their heart broke just as much as ours would do at the loss of a child or the death of a loved one. And the minute we start to think they were different, they didn't feel the same as us, well, that's a very, very dangerous route to go down. So that's why I love to look back, because I think it tells us who we are now.
Mm. Yeah, that's wonderful. And I think that's something that comes across so strongly in the book. These characters are so painted so vividly, and you really feel all of the traumatic things that they go through. That was one of the things that I enjoyed the most about it, and particularly the central character of Minu. But I'm not going to give too much away, obviously, because I want people to read it for themselves. So today we're just going to focus on the year that the book opens in, I think. So if you could travel back in time to any year, what year would you choose?
Well, I've chosen the year 1572, which is, as you say, the year that the City of Tears opens. It's 10 years after the outbreak of the Wars of Religion. There have been three wars and uneasy peaces in that decade. And there is now a proper chance of peace, of this being over. The background is very straightforward in a funny sort of way. Wars of religion are never about faith, as we know. They're always about power and influence. And there was a triumvirate, I suppose you could say, at court, all fighting, all jostling for power. There was a weak king, Charles, who was the third son of Catherine de' Medici. Her two older sons, who were more suited to being kings, had been killed. And she had ended up with Charles, who she had been the regent for some time, and he was a strange and quite disturbed person by the sounds of things. It's hard to know, obviously. There's Admiral de Coligny, who is the leader of the Huguenots, and Henry of Navarre, who is the great hope of the Huguenots. He is a Huguenot. And then there is the Catholic family of Guise, who are very powerful and stirring up trouble. And all three of these individuals, if you like, are essentially fighting at court for control of the king. Then the two queens, Catherine de' Medici and Henry of Navarre's mother, Jeanne d'Albret, another powerful queen, the Queen of Navarre, they broker a marriage between their children. Henry does not want to marry Marguerite de Valois. Marguerite de Valois does not want to marry Henry, but they don't have much choice in the matter. There are rumours that Marguerite is indeed the lover of Henry of Guise. So it is a real sort of absolutely extraordinary melting pot of vengeance and jealousy and a great deal at stake. But the marriage is brokered between these two extraordinary women, and then it all goes to hell in a handcart, essentially. So Jeanne d'Albret comes to Paris for the royal wedding, which is scheduled for the 18th of August, 1872. And when she arrives in June, she dies. There are many rumours that she has been poisoned. Poisoning was rife and everybody lived in fear of it at the court. And indeed, that day that she became ill, Catherine de Medici has sent round a pair of beautiful gloves that the rumour goes round that they had been poisoned, and she put the gloves on and she has died. And after 5 days, Jeanne d'Albret does die, but the wedding is still going to go ahead. And I think that you look back at this period of history and you think, you know, as a novelist, you can't improve on the history. All you can do is put your imaginary characters as witnesses to the history that we know or suspect.
Mm. I didn't know anything about the wars of religion until I read this book, and I was like, oh my God, it's not just the Reformation. It's like, it's everywhere.
It's so right. It is everywhere. And I think what fascinates me about this particular year is that, you know, the wedding is scheduled for the 18th of August and it goes ahead. And if you can imagine all of the emotions that were going on there, all the different factions watching, there is even a suggestion that Marguerite de Valois has not assented. Somebody has to push her head down when she's asked, do you assent to this marriage? And there's you know, there's discussion about that. She then goes on into Notre Dame, but her groom, her brand new husband, Henry of Navarre, cannot go in because he is a Huguenot. So the idea that these two young people, and they were young, sort of 1920, were going to sort all of, you know, France's problems out, I mean, it's an enormous burden on anybody. But it happens. And we are talking to each other in the shadow of extraordinary history having been made on the 20th of January. And many people all over the world watching the inauguration of the 46th president of the United States, Joe Biden, who actually has Huguenot ancestry too. His middle name is Robinette. But the anticipation and the fear in some ways that everybody was watching that, would it go all right? Now, that is exactly as everybody was feeling in Paris on the 18th of August, 1572. And it looks like it has.
Jeanne d'Albret, she's staying in Paris, and that's the first scene that we're gonna travel back in time to. Could you tell us a bit about where she was staying and where we are
in that period of history? It was very common for the court, and there were several courts. So Navarre had its own court, and it was the leading Protestant court, obviously. And Navarre is right down in the south, essentially the border between what we think of now as France and Spain. And it was an independent sort of territory. And it was completely normal, however, for a court to be away from its primary palace for sometimes years and go on a voyage around their countries. So it wasn't at all odd that Jeanne d'Albret should have left her own court much, much earlier. The marriage was brokered and sealed essentially in April of that year, and be gently travelling up through France to arrive in Paris. And she is staying in the Bourbon Palace because the two great families of France were about to be joined, and they are the Bourbon dynasty and the Valois dynasty. You know, this period of time, we see the last of the Valois kings. And of course, Henry of Navarre himself will be crowned king of all France in 1594. And it will be the beginning of the Bourbon dynasty. And as I said, we also have the Guise family, who are another very powerful Catholic family. So Jeanne d'Albret has come with her court, essentially. And she is staying in the Bourbon Palace because they are the leading Huguenots there. It is complicated because the Duke of Bourbon is actually a Catholic, and there are many, many archbishops in the Bourbon side of the family who are mostly Catholic. So Jeanne d'Albret is an extraordinary woman. She is a scholar. She is a writer. She has ruled as Queen of Navarre since her husband's death. So although Henry is King of Navarre, he still is respectful to his mother, if you like. And so she has come to show good faith, I think. And of course, I have this in my novel, The City of Tears, in that the reason my imaginary Huguenot family, Minou, Joubert and her husband, Pete Redon, do decide to go to Paris is as senior Huguenots for the same reason as Jeanne d'Albret, to show good faith, that they believe that this is meant in the spirit of peace. So she has set up a court, you know, in the Bourbon Palace, and has not been there very long before she becomes ill. And she dies on the 9th of June, 1572. And there is a real chance then that the wedding will be stopped. But Catherine de' Medici, at this point, she sees the best hope for securing her line and making sure that nobody else gets the throne by marrying her only daughter, surviving daughter, as it were, off to Henry of Navarre. And that is indeed what happens. So she is the one that really holds it together. And Guise does not arrive in Paris till a couple of days before the wedding.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about, it seems that this period is actually full of quite a few really powerful, influential women and female monarchs. You've obviously got Catherine de Medici and the Queen of Queen of Navarre in France, but in England at this time you also have Elizabeth I and Mary Queen of Scots. So, and before Elizabeth I, Queen Mary as well. The kind of historical power of women is definitely a theme that you explore in the book a bit. And I was just desperate to kind of talk to you a bit about it. There was one bit I was really struck by that I made a note of. A bit later in the book, you talk about an army of women in Amsterdam who are using their powers of moderation and persuasion to get the men to lay down their weapons. This is later in the book, not in Paris, but that is a kind of theme throughout the book, that there are these women who are influencing political activity around them in their own way with the tools that they have available to them. And it struck me that that's what these two queens are doing as well, rather than opting for violence or war like had been happening for the last 10 years. As the wars raged on, they had brokered this marriage instead. Do you think that was a particularly, I don't want to overgeneralize, like a particularly feminine thing to do, but what do you think about these two female, powerful female characters and the role they were playing in history?
What I feel is, and I feel this very, very strongly, I mean, I write historical fiction with women heroes, because for me, the hero is the protagonist of a story. It's the person with agency, the person who drives the plot forward. So my heroes are women. But what I think beyond that, that matters, is that we know, and listeners will know this because history is the thing that unites us all, is that the discipline of history in terms of writing the events of the past and it becoming studied in the universities was until very recently in terms of time, a pretty much solely male discipline. And consequently, an awful lot of what is therefore seen as the history with a capital letter is a very narrow narrative. And it is often only the story of kings and popes and generals. Religious leaders as well, you know, not just obviously Christians, but all of the other faiths. It also means, therefore, that women's contributions throughout history have often been left out of the history books. And you would be forgiven sometimes in the 16th century for thinking that there were no women except for queens, princesses and mistresses and a few, you know, people in the fields. But the truth is that the world has always been all of us and women were always there. Always part of things. The period of time I'm writing about in The City of Tears, the men had been at war for a generation. So who do we think were binding the books and writing the books and teaching the children to read and baking the bread and cutting the wood and opening the gates? You know, women. So it's very important to me to say, let's use some common sense here. We can see that we are being told a partial version of history. And it's that old cliche of history is written by the victor. It's a cliche because it's true, but it's also history is written with an agenda. And the agenda is that men did stuff and women were at home. It was never true. There are periods of, you know, women's expectations in different periods of history and their confinement, absolutely. But in terms of women being bright, intelligent human beings, that has always been the case. It sounds absurd to need to say it out loud, but often in history, it's easy to forget that because women are very absent from much history. So with this period, there are a lot of powerful women in the courts, and that does make it very unique in some respects, but there are also powerful women everywhere else. And I wouldn't use the word feminine. Mm. I would say that it is pragmatism. And the fact that Catherine de Medici and Jeanne d'Albret. They both, you know, they're tough women. They've lost children. And I don't for a minute want to suggest that men losing children, their hearts don't break too. But I think that there is something particular with this period of history. You know, Catherine de Medici had a lot of children, and you know, they did not all survive even to adulthood. And even the ones that did survive to adulthood, you know, she outlived pretty much the lot. And that must be heartbreaking, obviously. But more to the point, that France was bankrupting itself by these wars. They were losing a lot of the most wonderful people, but also they were bankrupting. Both sides were being bankrupted. And I think that a lot of the brokering of the marriage deal is about that, about the land is being decimated. We can't afford to keep fighting. We don't want to keep losing the best and the brightest of our young men to wars and never seeing them. Let's see if we can try to bring peace. So that I think it's pragmatism versus belligerence, if you like, is how I see it, more than feminine versus masculine.
Just to go back to the scene that we're at the Hotel de Bourbon, I would love you to paint a picture of what this court looks like. I know that Catherine de Medici was very famous for, she was a patron of the arts, and there was lots of great kind of festivities going on. Would that be similar for this particular court as well? I'd love you to paint a bit of a picture of what scene we're in.
Yes, the Hôtel de Bourbon, as it would have been known, but it's essentially a grand stately home, is also on the banks of the Seine. It is slightly further upriver than the Louvre, but very, very close by. So they are, you know, kissing cousins, as it were. And there will have been beautiful glass in the windows, tall, high windows overlooking the water. The windows will very probably have been shut because the Seine was, as well as being the waterway and a place for trade, was also where people did their washing, where people washed, where people did all of those other things. So it was not a clean and fragrant stretch of river, shall we say. So there would have been that. It would have been it was August, and it was a humid August. There'd been a bad harvest that year. There'd been a lot of rain earlier on. So Paris is a city that's ready to blow, I would say. Because there's quite a lot of poverty. There's all these visitors have come from all over Europe, and particularly all the Huguenots have come in. So all the houses are occupied by visitors and foreign visitors, and they have brought their funny ways with them, as it were. And Henry of Navarre, you know, one of the things Marguerite de Valois said, you know, about him, that you could see that he was coming from, you know, a long way away because of the smell of his breath, because he chewed raw garlic all the time. And he wore his hair en brosse, which basically means sort of combed right back off his forehead and down. Now, that was so far from the glamour of the Catholic court that she, you know, thought he looked like a peasant. You know, she was very unimpressed with the look of him and the smell of him and all of these things. So in the Bourbon Palace, there will have been some Catholics, obviously, because Bourbon himself was Catholic, but it will have been much more austere. You would be able to tell at a glance that you were in a Catholic court, but the Bourbon court was Huguenot. I mean, that Jeanne d'Albret's court, as it were, not the Bourbon palace itself, but Jeanne d'Albret's people were Huguenot, because the huge difference in dress. And the Huguenots tended to wear black. They tended to wear quite modest high collars. Ruffs and cuffs were detachable in those days, but they wore small ruffs rather than enormous, great big ostentatious ruffs. Their hair tended to be, you know, oiled down and very unostentatious. The women would, you know, everybody's hair would be covered. But if you went into the Louvre Palace, you would see velvet and silk and gold. And the Duke of Anjou, who most histories would suggest was gay, and he had all of his followers around him, was incredibly flamboyant. So wore his hair in ringlets. All his followers wore their hair in ringlets. They wore, you know, silks and huge ruffs, and carried lots of pets around in bags, like monkeys and dogs. And so you would know which court you were in just at a glance. Also, of course, in these big spaces, they are designed for you know, there are small chambers off it, but the big spaces were designed. They were going to hold some of the feasting in the Bourbon Palace. Some would be in the Louvre. You know, they were going to move about. So there would be an enormous central hall where a masque would be held or the banquet would be held. And that would be pretty much empty until the time that those things were going to happen. And then you'd have enormous, great big long tables and benches. There would be much more opulent chairs, almost like thrones, that would be at the end of the room. There would be drapes. There would be musicians with long single-valved trumpets with sort of, you know, pennants hanging off them. But all of that would come in for the particular events. So I think, as I imagine it, a quiet atmosphere in the Bourbon Palace, a thoughtful atmosphere, maybe a bookish atmosphere, where there is a slightly febrile atmosphere in the Louvre. And Catherine de Medici has her own house. She doesn't live in the Louvre all the time. And she is building her own palace in the Tuileries Gardens, just a little bit down the way, but it's not finished yet.
Hello, it's Artemis. At Travels Through Time, we're incredibly proud to be partnering with Jordan Lloyd and Colourgraph. Jordan is one of the world's leading visual historians. Through his excellent craftsmanship, he brings black and white photographs of the past to life in startling colour and clarity. Jordan's extraordinary work, as well as that of his contemporaries, can be found on the website colourgraph.co. At colourgraph.co, you'll be able to explore the process and history behind the colourisation work, but most excitingly of all, you can also buy some of these beautiful photographs as museum-grade fine art prints. They make an unusual and striking present for that friend or family member of yours who loves the past, and they're an excellent addition to any room. Whether it's a colourised photograph of the US Capitol building from 1846, or a candid shot of the Beatles from 1964, you're pretty sure to find something that enchants you. I know I certainly have many times. It's hard to explain really over audio just how cool these prints are, so I encourage you to have a look for yourself at colourgraph.co. What's more, Travels Through Time listeners get 10% off when they enter the code TTT at the checkout. That's fascinating. Yeah, I love that really visible visual difference. Yeah, I can really picture it. So she sent these gloves and she's, well, we don't know if the gloves were the reason behind her death, but she dies very tragically. It seems so, the timing is somewhat suspicious, but I think that maybe it's time for us to move on to the second scene, which is the main event, which is the reason that these two very different courts, these two very different dynasties have met in this amazing city. And that is the wedding itself. So would you like to tell us a bit about the wedding between these two young people?
Well, I had a wonderful time writing the wedding scene. I usually don't put real historical figures on the page. I really admire people who do and do it well, but I always feel slightly uneasy about putting my imagined words in the mouths of real people who lived and died, for fear of distorting the history or distorting them. However, with this, they simply had to, there had to be a few scenes with the protagonists on stage because my imagined characters have come to witness that. So the day of the wedding, it's the 18th of August. There have been extraordinary constructions made from the Louvre Palace to Notre Dame, which is where the wedding is going to take place. A platform has been built all the way so that Marguerite de Valois will never have to put her perfect feet on the ground, that she will be able to kind of glide. Marguerite de Valois wrote about it. So we have her descriptions of her wedding dress and the train and all of these things. So it's not relying on external observers, if you like to write this down. She wrote these things herself because it was, you know, an unhappy marriage and they were divorced and she was sent into exile. She made good use of that tragic exile, really, by writing so much of it up. So This platform, this wooden platform, it's not very far, really, from the Louvre to Notre Dame. Anybody will know that Notre Dame is on a little island. At that stage, there were, you know, just one big island and lots of little islands at that stage. And there are wooden bridges that that take everybody on from both sides, the left and the right bank. But this platform was built and it was covered in gold, not heavy, you know, gold, but gold material. So she looked like a vision. And people in wealthier houses would have paintings on the wall, of course. But for many, the ordinary people, as it were, of Paris, the colour and the beauty they saw in their life would be in these things, would be in the cathedrals, would be in the outside of the grand buildings. They didn't own these things for themselves. So I can just imagine her with her train and all of the attendants and her mother, who always wore black. We also know that Henry of Guise has arrived in Paris the day before the wedding and has set every maiden's heart aflutter. And he is described, you know, as golden. You know, he's a golden man, and he comes with huge numbers of attendants, and everybody is beautifully decked out. So it's an extraordinary scene. They have built in what they call the pavé, you know, the paradise outside Notre Dame, you know, the stone in front of the west door. Big stands on both sides for the favoured guests. And the wedding, because he is a Huguenot, is happening outside the cathedral, not inside, which is, again, an extraordinary thing. So, you know, I imagine it almost looking like a joust, that the Catholics are on this side, the Huguenots are on that side, their colours and their clothes tell them apart. And then in the middle, you have this young woman and a young man who, for dynastic reasons, are about to be joined together. And the service happens. When she is asked, do you take this man? It looks like nothing happens. Her brother, King Charles, forces her head down. And that is gossip in the streets afterwards. Did she assent? Are they really married? And then after the wedding has taken place, the whole of her party go into the cathedral of Notre Dame for a benediction. And Henry is left outside with his men because they are Huguenot. I mean, you couldn't get a more brilliant visual image of what divided France than that. The thing that is, I find quite touching about it, is that it is clear that actually they both had, Henri of Navarre and Marguerite de Valois, did have a certain amount of respect for one another's intellect. They came to respect one another. And in the events that are to follow in the next few days, she plays quite a significant role in saving his life.
Really? I mean, I'll resist the urge to ask you more about that because I want to save it all for the final scene that we're visiting. But could you tell us a bit more about her? I know that she's this great romantic heroine in lots of ways, or she's become a great romantic heroine. She's the subject of the heroine of the famous novel by Alexandre Dumas. And I know that you wrote in the introduction to your book that you were somewhat inspired by his book, Lorraine Margot.
Yes, she wasn't entirely unwilling. From that point of view, she wanted status. But what, of course, will happen in the future is that she will find that, oddly, she has less power than she believed, that the inadequate brothers will be chosen over her, of course, because France in the north had that system of the male heir mattered more than the female heir, that, you know, didn't inherit. Whereas we, at that moment in England, as it then was, have a queen on the throne in her own right. So it is very interesting. So I think she is seen as a great romantic heroine. I would say she was her mother's daughter. I think she had a lot more of her mother in her than people often credit. I think Catherine de Medici has been dealt a very bad hand in history by male historians and biographers who have not approved of her power and her wielding of it. Would I like to sit down and have dinner with her? Probably not. But I would say that a lot of what she did would have been seen as a strength in a man, whereas it was dismissed as interfering where she shouldn't have done because she was a woman. And I think Marguerite took after her in many, many ways.
Well, I think that leads us on perfectly to our third and final scene that you're going to take us to. Would you like to introduce where we are? This is the 24th of August. It's about 4 days after the wedding's taken place. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, the bells start to ring out. It is one of the most extraordinary moments in history, in that we will never know for sure who gave the order that there was to be a massacre and actually what was intended. There are two separate things there. So we know that there were meetings in the Louvre Palace between Catherine de Medici, the king, and Henry of Guise. We do not know who was saying, we must kill the leading Huguenots. They were known as the War Huguenots. Coligny, who is the senior thinking Huguenot, I suppose, if you like, the leader of the, you know, separate from Henry of Navarre, is very beloved of King Charles. And Guise and Catherine de' Medici fear his influence over the very fragile and emotionally immature king. Coligny is summoned to see the king. And on his way home from that, on the 22nd of August, he is shot. He is shot by an assassin who is in a house that is owned by the Guise family. But many houses are owned by the Guise family. And you can't say for sure that they knew he was there. The assassin also gets away, which suggests that there has been proper planning of this. And Coligny is badly wounded, but he is not killed. And he is taken into his quarters. And this is a very extraordinary turning point in history because the king himself comes to say sorry and to say, I'm going to root out whoever did this. This is a disgrace. You know, you have my support. But yet, a few days later, a few hours later, really, on the very, very late on the night of the 23rd, but it's either the eve or the 24th of August, which is St. Bartholomew's Day, the tocsin bell begins to ring out, which is an alarum bell. And it rings out from Saint-Germain d'Auxerrois, which is a church by the Louvre Palace, which is essentially the parish church of the Louvre Palace. So, and somewhere between King Charles visiting Coligny and giving him his word that he will be protected, and a few hours later, Guise arrives at Coligny's dwellings with armed men. They hack their way in. They go up to the bedchamber where Guise is lying. They drag him, a wounded and old man for those days, out of bed. They throw him out of the window and decapitate him, and his head is held up. And that is essentially the sign for a massacre to begin. A lot of historians would say that what happened was not intended, that there was a deliberate attempt to kill the senior Huguenots, absolutely. The idea that they were all gathered together in Paris, this was a great opportunity, and therefore they would assassinate the Huguenot leadership. And that certainly was planned and prosecuted, and almost all of them were murdered. Henry of Navarre and a few others were spared because of Marguerite de Valois' intervention. He had to convert to Catholicism, and he was essentially held a prisoner for the next few years within Paris and the Louvre Palace. But he is not killed. But almost all the other war Huguenots are murdered. People have been being white marks on their doors to show which are Catholic houses and which are inhabited by Huguenots. And there's also an idea that the Catholics have got white scarves tied around their arms so that they can be identified too. So there is clearly a properly planned assassination. But then what happens instead is, or possibly this was intended to, is that the combination of 3 days of drinking and feasting, the overcrowded streets, the temperatures running high, tempers overboiling, that what in those days would be called a bloodlust takes over, and the mob takes over and runs riot. And so rather than the senior Huguenots only, during the course of St. Bartholomew's Day and that night, maybe as many as 3,000 people are hacked to death, men, women, children. Many of them are slaughtered by the sword. Some are burnt. There are bonfires burning everywhere. Many of them drown and are thrown into the Seine because, oddly, for people who live by rivers and sailed on boats, many, many people did not swim in those days. And chains are put across the streets of Paris to stop people from fleeing. And this is where the research to the size of the streets and the medieval streets is so important. And of course, all the gates of Paris are barred.
So in light of the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre, do you think that the wedding and the political aim of the wedding has been made redundant? Is it helpful at all in resolving the conflict between the two sides, or does it kind of fall by the wayside and is overshadowed by the massacre?
It's completely overshadowed by the massacre because many of the surviving Huguenots, the one that escape, believe therefore that it was all a plot just to get them all to Paris. And it means that the conflict comes more bitter. There will be another, you know, essentially five wars will happen now. It will be attritional. It will bring France to her knees. It will destroy France's coffers. Catherine de' Medici will see all of her sons take the throne and die, one after the other. So then Henry of Navarre will be the King of France, but Paris will never accept him. And he is forced to convert to Catholicism after this wedding. And then he escapes a few years later and then becomes a Huguenot again. But in the end, he will convert, and he will convert to Catholicism with the famous words, Paris is well worth a mass. And he will be crowned, unlike all the other kings of France, in Chartres Cathedral, because still everywhere else is still slightly dangerous territory, is still disputed territory. And it will be the main conflict against him will be Henry of Guise. He will be his main enemy. And indeed, there is a war that is called the War of the Three Henrys, which is a de Valois Henry, a Guise Henry, and a Navarre Henry. And it is known as the War of the Three Henrys. But in the end, Henry of Navarre is crowned in 1594, and he does bring peace to France, and every normal person in France has had enough. And it is a tragedy of quite epic proportions that he will be assassinated by a crazed Catholic monk in 1610. I haven't double checked, but I'm pretty sure it's 1610 that he will be assassinated. And then France will be plunged back into persecuting the Huguenots, and it will lead, the Edict of Nantes gives a certain amount of religious freedom to the Huguenots, and his grandson, Louis, will revoke that in the famous revocation of the Edict of Nantes in 1688. And the few final remaining Huguenots will leave French soil at that moment. So it is the most incredible period of French history, and one that I'm obviously reveling writing about.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, such powerful emotional events, like just really affecting. And then that's what's so great about this book, because you're, like you say, your characters are witness to these events, and it makes you think what it is to be a witness to history as we are at the moment, like you were saying at the start. So just before we head back to the present, to much safer, well, comparatively safer time, you're allowed to bring back a memento with you from the year 1572. And I was just wondering what memento you'd like to bring back.
I found this really hard to decide what I would bring back, in a way, but because there were so many extraordinary women writing so many extraordinary books. So I wanted to think, well, could I, bring Jeanne d'Albret's library back with me? All of these sorts of things. But in the end, I thought actually something, given my intention is always to put the ordinary people, the people like me, back into history, that I would want to bring something that any Huguenot might have owned. And I think, therefore, I would bring a little steel Huguenot cross that might have been worn on a belt. It might have been worn, just carried in a pocket. It might have been worn on a chain around the neck. And they were very widespread. And they're almost like stars, four fans that meet in the middle with little sort of details between them. And it was quite a distinctive cross. And it would be one of those things that people would carry, and you would, in very difficult times, be able to show, and you would know that this person was a friend, not a foe. It'd be like almost like a secret symbol. But also in better times were worn very visibly as a piece of jewellery, or a sort of statement of faith, a very clear statement of faith, much less ornate than the very lavish crucifixes that the Catholics were wearing, that would often be, covered in jewels and sapphires and diamonds and all of these things. So a sort of a steel Huguenot cross that had seen some action, and that I would just keep on my desk beside my computer. And there's the wonderful phrase from the very great Neil McGregor, who used to be, of course, in charge of the British Museum and is now sadly lost to us in Germany, is doing amazing things there. But he always called this the charisma of things, the idea that certain objects, when you hold them, they're kind of infused with all the history and all the biographies of the people that have gone before and have held that same object. So I think a Huguenot cross in the palm of my hand would be just perfect.
Sounds wonderful. Yeah, I love that. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you and to relive this adventure of a book. I really could not recommend it highly enough to any listeners, and it's been such a pleasure to speak to you.
Thank you. It's been lovely to be able to just talk about history for a bit.
Yeah, exactly. That was me, Artemis Irvin, talking to Kate Moss about the year 1572. One of the things that I enjoyed most about my conversation with Kate was just how sensory all of her descriptions were. The different colours of the Catholic and the Huguenots' clothes, the smell of the city after 6 days of celebration, the heat in August, and even the shape and size of the streets that people would have been walking down. I really hope that you enjoyed the interview too. It looks like we might be indoors for a little bit longer yet, so if you're looking for an adventure, I can't recommend The City of Tears enough. It's published by Pam Macmillan, and it's available to buy right now. But until next week, goodbye.